document the spaghetti bolognese cheese crisis.
Was there not enough cheese? Was there too much cheese? There's no such thing as too much cheese.
It's off. I didn't think cheese went off. I think it just sort of turned into Stilton. But
it doesn't really last long enough in our house, I think, to go off.
My daughter just came in and went, it's off. And then I went, well, there's nothing I can do about it because I'm about to go in and do a podcast. And she just sort of stared at me like, but what am I going to do?
Yeah. But the cheese.
that crisis will carry on outside. I'm sure I'll hear some banging in a bit and somebody will go down the corner shop and spend £8 on a tiny block of cheese.
Be worth it, though.
Oh, God, yeah, for sure.
I mean, I lived for a short period of time. I lived for 2 years in a village called Long Whittenham. It's not a small village. I mean, it's got a pub and an Indian restaurant, but no shop, and doesn't have any buses, even though it's really close to Oxford. Yeah, if you were having a spaghetti bolognese cheese crisis, you had to drive to Didcot. And that's the last thing I want to do when I'm just about to have spaghetti bolognese with cheese.
I mean, I lived 10 years in a village with no shop one terrible pub.
We have a shop, and during COVID, the guy was the most pro-lockdown you could ever imagine because he was just coining it in.
Lockdown.
Queue outside my shop. Minimum spend £300.
The pub in your old village, they just stopped.
Like 3 years afterwards, they were still serving you through the window.
And they'd
put chairs all in front of the, when everything opened again, they put chairs in front of the bar so you couldn't stand at the bar.
And at one point they had actually, because it was one of those pubs that has two bars, one on the left, one on the right. And they just made the right one their new living room.
Yeah.
And like you walked in and you kind of looked, you saw there was like a lady there, just sort of sat down doing her knitting with like a sofa. And like, you know, it was very much just the scene of somebody's living room. And she looked up at you in a kind of like, what the hell are you doing in my house kind of thing? And I'm like, I just wanted a cup of beer.
No, it's closed.
Yeah.
There is now nothing in that village. So.
In like record time. Hmm. Let's get on to the actual kind of content, shall we? Yeah, so we're going to have a look at managers. We spent a lot of time in previous episodes talking about players from certain eras, but actually we thought it would be worth having an episode where we just kind of talk through the various managers we've had. I don't think it needs to be any more of a complicated intro than that, because I've got some statistics that I've put together, probably worth starting about who do we reckon, statistically speaking, is our most successful manager. Like, how are you I was going to come up with some great way of factoring into consideration how long somebody had been manager, kind of notable achievements like league wins or promotions or cup wins or Wembley finals and things like that. I didn't do that in the end. But so I'm just going to look initially at kind of win percentage in terms of who's, well, you know, just kind of statistical, who's won the most, who was the most successful in terms of games they won. In pure numbers, who do you think is the most successful manager that we've ever had? Anybody who has been at the club for more than one stint, we're taking their stints as separate stints, as kind of separate situations.
I'm going to duck out because I've printed off the entire list of our managers, which includes all the win percentages.
I'm always amazed how prepared everybody else is. I'm going to say Jim Smith. First time round, obviously, not second time. Yeah.
Statistically speaking, with 100% win ratio,
it's going to be someone,
Craig Short.
Yeah.
His second stint as caretaker manager.
No, but that's but like also, people who say that, you know, Mike Salmon is our worst ever goalie because he played once and conceded 7 goals. It doesn't count.
It doesn't. Of course, it doesn't count.
In the same way that nobody says that Guy Whittingham is our best striker.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And my reason for bringing that up is because second in the list of the most successful managers of all time for Oxford United is committee of board members with a win percentage of 54.5%. They were in place, I think it was between Harry Thompson and Arthur Turner, I think. Right. Anyway, very, very early on.
That's right.
They're in charge for 11 games. They won 6 of them and lost 5.
Doesn't fit into a chant quite as well, though, does it?
It doesn't, no.
We are Oxford Committee of Board Members, is our
I mean, firstly, I'm amazed because three out of four of us have basically done the same piece of research. The thing that jumped out to me about the comparisons to early days and late days is that our first four named managers, so not including the board of committees, so Harry Thompson, Arthur Turner, Ron Saunders and Jerry Summers managed 1,275 games between them, which is the equivalent of our last 26 managers. The question that jumped into my head was, why would anyone want to be a football manager? So my Oxford United life span, it goes back to Ian Greaves in 1980. There's been 37 managers in that time, 25 of them permanent. They average 64 games each, just over a season.
I guess, you know, I mean, these days, if you're going to get sacked, you probably get a nice payoff. So maybe there's a bit of a win-win situation.
But definitely now, because why would you go into a job where you're likely to get sacked after 18 months maximum?
But why is anybody still taking the Watford job, for example?
And I genuinely don't know what kind of contract they go on, but like there was one point, and I genuinely can't remember who the manager was, so it's a crap anecdote. But there was a manager, it's a Premier League manager, it was Sam Allardyce or something like that. That somebody figured out that he was at any one point being paid off by like six different clubs at the same time. And I think that's probably part of it, isn't it? We were talking the other day about why Graham Potter hasn't had a job yet. And the thing is that he joined Chelsea at the point when Chelsea were handing out like 9-year contracts to everybody to get around the fair play rules, allegedly. I don't want to get sued by Chelsea. But he almost certainly will be paid like several million pounds a year for the next like 8 years. Mm. So he's in no rush to get another job.
Yeah. But it's the ritual humiliation of being fired. A majority of our managers, I would say, have left under some kind of cloud. There's not many of them that have come out of it still, you know, with a rosy glow.
So a lot of them, though, haven't needed us to ritually humiliate them. They've kind of quite adequately.
But it's a reasonable point, though. And in without wanting to kind of kick off the whole thing talking about somebody else's manager, and I forget the bloke's name, but I was looking at the Burton Albion fans.
Did we have a crap anecdote jingle?
No, because it will get used against me all the time. But the abuse and the grief that the Burton Albion manager, who's only been in place for like less than half a season so far, the absolute unbelievable levels of grief and abuse that guy was having thrown at him. Yeah, it's like a really strange position to want to put yourself into.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, Des Buckingham has a similar situation, maybe not quite as bad, but after only a few months, there's a lot of people on his back.
Yeah, no, I don't know. It's a weird, weird job. I don't know what the stats are, but, you know, the amount of time that managers get now in football is just decreasing year by year by year, like the average length of time that managers stay at football clubs, to the point where it's almost meaningless now, because you can't genuinely make a difference unless you've had what I'm going to say like two seasons is a reasonable amount of time. After two seasons of watching a manager, you've got a pretty good idea of which direction they're going in. And I do understand that you have to take a point that there's a line at which the risk gets too great within those 2 years, so you might have to pull the plug. There's largely no point in appointing a manager unless you're going to give him a couple of seasons to have a proper crack at it.
Yeah, and that is something that doesn't happen now. Because I was thinking that when we were doing the quiz a couple of pods ago about Dennis Smith's first match in charge, because that was like beginning of September, and we were relegated that season. But they kept him on. It just wouldn't happen. He wouldn't have stayed on. But at the time, you know, everyone could sort of see that he'd inherited a bad squad. He brought in some good players.
But I guess, I mean, if you look at our list of managers, two or three of them had sort of glittering playing careers, but not in times where you would have made a lot of money. Laurenson, Mark Wright and Graham Ricks had great careers. Ramon Diaz is an outlier, of course. He had the greatest playing career of the lot, won Serie A, etc. But I guess it's a case of you reach a point where you know, you need to start looking at your future, and if you want to stay in the industry that you know and yeah, how many jobs are there in football once you've retired? I guess you go, you know, you look at going into management and coaching. But what I don't understand is why someone like Wayne Rooney seems hell-bent on destroying his reputation by being such a mediocre to bad manager. You know, his legacy is just becoming tainted.
It does seem to me that good players don't necessarily become good managers. I mean, you look at our last two our last three managers haven't had big playing careers at all, barely played at any kind of level. And also, I look around and I think because of the age I am, I feel like all of the managers should be players that I remember.
I wonder whether part of that is that if you've had a stellar playing career, it is very difficult to get your head around the idea that some players are better than others. You're always going to have this weird mix of players and you've got to be able to blend them as a team. There's the classic example, I'm sure I've used it before, about Glenn Hoddle trying to get Swindon players to spray 60-yard passes across the field and they just couldn't do it. And Glenn Hoddle just didn't understand. Just do it this way. And he'd just do another one. They'd just sort of stand there wondering what's going on. And I wonder whether that kind of plays against those players. Things came quite naturally to them. They don't quite understand that it doesn't come naturally to everyone else.
It's almost like there's a career coaching path now where people are identified early on as potential. So you don't necessarily have had to have, in political terms, you know, had a career elsewhere, had work experience, had been a trade unionist, whatever. You just get put on this path to power. And someone like Des Buckingham has kind of gone that route without having any playing career to talk of.
That's another point that crossed my mind. To what degree is luck in all of this? This might be a neat segue into some of our favourite managers, because I'm pretty sure Michael Appleton might be in that list. But Michael Appleton's management career has not gone that well outside of Oxford. Is he not as good a manager as we like to believe, and he got lucky for a couple of seasons with us?
I don't think it was luck, but I just think that everything, you know, with Eales and Ashton as well, and he was able to bring in the type of player that he wanted because he spoke a lot about the DNA, didn't he? And you could hear when you were listening to them being interviewed, you could tell what he was looking for in a player. It wasn't just what was on the pitch. I felt it was a personality thing. So I think he was able to do that, which he's maybe not been able to since then. It does tend to go to sort of car crash clubs as well, doesn't he?
I think when I say luck, I don't necessarily mean that it was a pure accident, but it was that combination of factors
that he
wouldn't necessarily find anywhere else. Mm. There's very, very few people who consistently deliver from one club to another. Amazingly, Steve Evans is one of them.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever you think about Steve Evans, he delivers at pretty much every club he's been at.
Yeah, and so is Chris Wilder.
But again, a lot of these things come down to the level at which they are managing, because Steve Evans has successfully delivered at every club that he's been at, that has been at Conference League Two and League One level, more or less. He had a foray into the Championship, didn't he? Didn't go quite so well. And I think...
Leeds, wasn't it?
Yeah. Interestingly, with Michael Appleton, I saw somebody saying... So after he got sacked by Charlton, when he got sacked by Charlton, someone saying, oh, you know, that's probably the end of his managerial career now. And I was like, maybe. The one thing that has been consistent in Michael Appleton's, for want of a better word, failures, is that they've all been at a higher level than the level he succeeded at. So there's either been League One or Championship. So I don't want to say, because I absolutely love Michael Appleton for the reasons we've already spoken about. Maybe he's just an absolutely exceptional League Two manager and a fairly ordinary League One manager. Mm. I think with Appleton, as we said, I think there was just like there was this kind of, it wasn't just on the pitch as well. And I think we've spoken about this before. I've certainly had conversations about this before, where off the pitch as well, so much kind of came together. He was kind of at the helm of this kind of incredible thing, which I just don't know whether or not you're ever going to get that every time, you know, maybe once in a career kind of situation.
Yeah.
There was an element with Appleton around, and I picked this up after the win against Swansea that season, because we got picked up by a lot of national media immediately afterwards, as you'd expect, because of the Giant killing. And it was this sudden feeling we were a modern football club.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Appleton did do. Our recruitment was innovative, and I mean, even the training was scientific. And like you say, we it all gelled off the pitch. It was all gelling.
It'd be really interesting to know what would have happened with his career had he not taken the decision to go to Leicester. We were like, oh, why would he want to be a cone carrier for a Premier League team? They're sticking a zero on the end of his salary for a start. Mm. But also going to be part of the coaching team at the Premier League champions is a pretty big draw, I think. I do get that decision, but I do also wonder, just as we were talking the other week about Liam Manning and his decision to leave Oxford when he did, may not have been the right one. Well, I guess what I'm saying is it's clearly a terrible idea to leave Oxford United as manager. Unless we're Chris Wilder, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought that was a terrible idea. I mean, I think everybody thought that was a... We were on the edge of the playoffs, weren't we? And he joined Northampton, who were about to be relegated to the conference.
I think at that point, he'd probably taken us as far as he could. And I think he knew it. I mean, he was looking to get out, wasn't he? He applied for the Portsmouth job. But we were slumping, you know, like we always did under him. It was just going the same way. I think he probably thought, I'm done with this. I don't think I can take this any further than I have done.
The summer before he left, Ian Lenegan kind of came out with this big statement about the future vision of Oxford, and it involved having a majority of the side being born within 5 miles of the ground. Or what he was saying in code was we were going to basically develop youth players because it was cheaper than buying in professionals. And I remember during that press conference, and then Lenegan was saying something along the lines of, and Chris Wilder is going to deliver it. And you could see in Wilder's face this kind of like, I don't want to deliver it. This is not what I want to do. I'm stuck. You know,
he didn't really play a lot of the youngsters, did he? He wasn't a big fan of that. I'd forgotten about that. It was a bit of a bizarre statement, really.
Also, Chris Wilder, I think the sense that you got from him was that he was quite spendy, and you know, quite a thoughtful character as well. And I think he probably got his way quite a lot. I think it kind of was inevitable. I think he just, how many games did he have? I mean, he's
269. Well, Andy, you mentioned Chris Wilder being a bit spendy, and it kind of made me think of one of our disgraced former managers, that being Mark Wright, not in relation to his time with us, but more so it's one of his times at Chester. For those who don't know, so Mark Wright was a youth team player with us. He went to Southampton, on to Liverpool, had a pretty decent playing career, played for England, and then became our manager the end of the season 2001. And actually, Mark Wright was manager when we moved to the Kassam, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was his first game. The start of that season.
Yeah. So this is from the 19th of November 2001, so just 3 months after the start of the season. The Football Association has been urged to act over alleged racial abuse in the game after a referee made an allegation against former England defender Mark Wright. Wright, manager of 3rd Division Oxford United, denied any allegations of racism made by the black referee Joe Ross. The FA found Wright guilty of abusive, indecent and insulting language, but failed to follow up the race claims. Wright said he's been charged with foul and abusive language, and he denied all the allegations. In the home game against Scunthorpe United, which was on the 20th of October 2001, which was designated Racial Awareness Day.
Well, it did create racial awareness, I suppose.
Yeah, taking it a little bit too literally. So a few days later, this is from The Guardian, Kassam says, racism is not something you should be allowed in football, which is why I'm taking the stand that I'm taking. I've got to be fair to Mark. He has been given the chance to put his side of the story. However, last Friday, Oxford United appointed Ian Atkins as director of football until the end of the season, and handed him full managerial powers, so it's difficult to see how Wright can retain his job. Outside of football, he then went on to get a restraining order from his ex-wife, and this relates to his time then at Chester City, where I didn't realise the specifics of this, but he had an affair and ended up living with the fiancée of Wayne Hatswell. Does anyone else remember that?
I remember him having an affair with one of the players' wives, but I didn't realise it was Wayne Hatswell.
Yeah, so this is all connected. It's all connected. Wow. This is August 2004, and Chester City Football Club directors are accusing Mark Wright of personal and professional misconduct. He'd been given the benefit of the doubt in August 2003 after denying having a relationship with the fiancé of Chester player Wayne Hatswell. Hatswell was then granted a transfer request to Kidderminster Harriers. The statement continued, during the summer of 2004, the pair were seen together on a trip to Dubai. He then refused to sign an improved contract unless he was contracts were given to his assistant, his scout and his kit man. He made it a further condition of his contract that Mr. Hatswell's former fiancé would be able to attend matches at the Diva Stadium. And then talks about Wright persistently flouting his managerial position over the size and budget of the first team squad, promising prospective players contracts without board permission, and having previously been told by the chairman that no more squad places were available. During his tenure, Mr. Wright made commitments to players regarding signing on fees and relocation expenses without the authority to do so. The board also claimed that Wright mismanaged contract negotiations with defender Phil Bolland right up to the point of his departure. Quite the character.
All of that said, his career as manager, particularly at Oxford United, was actually quite noteworthy. So he played 22, won 4, drew 7, lost 11, a win percentage of 18.2%. So, I mean, to be fair, it was a pretty easy decision to sack him.
Yeah.
All ends up, really.
I mean, it goes on. To 2006, he was then suspended by Peterborough. 1st of February 2006, Mark Wright was last night sacked as Peterborough United manager after failing to turn up for his own disciplinary hearing. It's a great line. Wright said, "Ask John Barnsley and Wright and John Fashanu if I'm a racist. The whole thing is a farce."
What did they say? Did they say anything? Nothing on record.
No, nothing quoted in the Daily Mirror anyway.
Some of my best mates are black footballers. When I say best mates, former colleagues. When I was looking at the ludicrous amounts of stats that are available on managers, I was struck by all of the ones who, the short-term managers, who have seemingly all have had some kind of significant impact. They're just kind of all very well remembered for very different reasons. I'm going to go run through them. We'll probably talk about most of these permanent managers, this is, with less than 50 games. In order of success, kind of win percentage at the top, we've got Liam Manning, Ramon Diaz, Pep Clatet, Brian Talbot, David Kemp, Graham Ricks, Mark Wright, Mark Lawrenson, and right at the bottom, you know, do you want to have a conversation about him, even though he's, to all intents and purposes, completely meaningless in Oxford United's history, Gary Waddock.
Except the one great thing he did.
Signed Danny Hilton.
But I remember in the run-up to his appointment, because it was actually quite a long time that they were going through this recruitment process, I said, this is a lot of faff and effort to go to for what will ultimately be a very disappointing name on a screen. it turned out to be a very disappointing name on a screen.
Even more disappointing than we'd anticipated.
I mean, much more disappointing. With all due respect, I've got absolutely no beef with Gary Waddock whatsoever, but it was... the weirdest tenure of a football manager.
It was really strange. And knowing that all that was happening, I can't understand why they didn't just leave Mickey in charge for the rest of that season.
Yeah.
There were some other names being bandied around at the time, like James Beattie. Yeah, he was kind of the favourite for a while, wasn't he?
Oh, he became Accrington manager.
Yeah, he did quite well.
Accrington, yeah. Since then.
Waddock certainly has it. No. I think that was the end of it for him.
Well, Waddock went on and he's become assistant manager in coaches and stuff like that, I think. And I think he still has a career. Somebody needs to check this. We need to get a fact checker on this. But I think he's now like a scout or something like that. But he has been assistant manager since at other clubs since leaving Oxford.
Apparently he's the assistant manager at Walsall.
There you go. Currently.
Yeah.
The other manager who managed to sustain a pretty serviceable career in football after leaving us was David Kemp.
He's one of Tony Pulis's loyal backroom staff,
yeah.
Wasn't he?
I mean, in a car crash, he was a car crash inside a car crash, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, that is a really good way of summing him up, I think. Such an unpleasant man.
He hated us and he hated managing us. And he didn't hold back at any point.
So his managerial record is played 31, won 7, drew 3, lost 21. It's a lot of games to lose.
What's really annoying is that when he got fired, he got interviewed afterwards and he said, yeah, changing the manager, that doesn't work, does it? And he was right. One of my calculations was that Firoz Kassam got rid of a manager every 26 games.
Impressive.
Head of a change, was he?
Ian Atkins had 122 yeah. games. So, I mean, that he's bumping that average up quite a lot.
He was the other person who I'd noticed has had a quite a serviceable career since leaving us. I mean, he did pretty well with us, I think. He sort of joined a number of big clubs as head of European recruitment. But my favourite thing about Atkins is his LinkedIn profile. Under Oxford, his two big achievements was helped reduce the club's budget by £1 million and developed and sold Dean Whitehead and Dexter Blackstock for a profit.
I mean, I'm going to take umbrage with that as well. I mean, he did not develop Dean Whitehead in any way whatsoever. Quite the opposite. He just allowed the ball to fly over his head most of the time.
But you're saying you liked the
Graham, I quite enjoyed the Ian Atkins era. But we won a lot of games, didn't we? Quite a good win percentage, didn't we?
I mean, we won a lot of games 1-0.
Yeah. A win.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The Ian Atkins era was weird because the club was sort of very slowly starting to unravel. As we've discussed previously, I think don't think Kassam particularly wanted to invest in the underlying infrastructure of the football club, which I think you can see at some of his hotels as well, from what I understand. I kind of do wonder if all of the managers who managed under Kassam's tenure, and probably the same for other chairmen at different times, but have to have a little asterisk next to them to sort of just say these were their achievements in spite of the football club that they were playing for rather than thanks to. But yeah, it was a really kind of strange period. And sort of when he left, it was whilst we had obviously something we'll come on to in a moment, I'm sure, the Ramon Diaz era, it was sort of the beginning of the end of our football club, potentially at one point. And, you know, and it took a very, very long time to recover from a lot of that.
It was, but I think, you know, at the same time, it had come off the back of sort of two or three really, really awful years. And whilst maybe that was all going on behind the scenes, it just felt like things had improved a lot on the pitch results-wise. But I don't know. To me, that was like my conference. Like, you know, everyone talks about the conference and how great fun it was going to all these games and everything. But I quite enjoyed that for the same reason. I remember going to Kidderminster one evening. It was like 300 of us and it was pissing down with rain and we won 3-1. It was brilliant. I had a great night. And I just really enjoyed that era.
Yeah, no, I agree. We beat Swindon in the Cup and we went to Highbury.
And that Charlton match in the cup as well, that was brilliant. Yeah.
I saw us at Carlisle. I saw us at York on a Tuesday night where I got fish and chips from a chip shop, which looked like it was serving from a living room. But I do think that's kind of one of the things about one of the managers is that in hindsight, you then see the context in which they're operating. The perceptions do change over time, over whether they were successful or whether you like them or not. And I quite liked Ian Atkins. And as time goes on, I like him more and more. I think, you know, he grabbed the club by the scruff of the neck and sort of dragged us through a couple of half-decent seasons.
And I think the hindsight thing is also something that you can apply to Brian Houghton, because I think at the time he was quite unpopular. I mean, people still, when a manager is under pressure, people still tweet Houghton out about that manager because he was just not very popular. And I think probably looking back unfairly because he'd come in as we were on our decline from the top flight. A lot of the sort of good players like Saunders and Hebbard left, and he was trying to rebuild a squad with not particularly, you know, not players that weren't the same standard.
It's only a chapter in his book about Oxford, but he does go through that when he took over from Lawrenson, he brought in John Dernan, he brought in Jim McGilton, he brought through Joey Beecham. His defence was Andy Melville and Kerry Evans. Paul Simpson was another one. And you look back on it and go, how the hell did he do that in the context of basically a club that had no money and was falling apart? Yeah.
I think one thing that I think made him very unpopular was, I think, the beginning of that 91-92 season. It was before Maxwell died. And we lost the first five games of the season. And he did an interview and they asked him what he thought the problem might be. And he said, well, it's simple. Some of the fans are having a go at me and it's affecting the players. So he basically was blaming the fans for our bad form. And I don't think that really went down very well.
Well, that was like Chris Wilder telling everybody that we had to forget winning the Milk Cup, which, again, I think he was probably right about ultimately.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I thought he had a good point. But he maybe just didn't execute
very
well.
Yeah.
Just going back to context, though, does Atkins stand out? I mean, it was a decent few years. But again, you look at this list of what came before, directly before and after him. Kemp, Wright, then Atkins, then, I don't even want to mention his name, Diaz, Tolbert. I mean, it's just, it's kind of like it's this beacon of the sort of turn of the century where we had Atkins and things weren't as bad.
I understand why you skipped over him, but I'm not going to skip over Graham Ricks. Take out of consideration all of the extremely obvious reasons why he shouldn't have been made Oxford United manager. And then inexplicably after he left Oxford, was it Hearts he went to? The thing that annoyed me most. But do you remember when he broke his leg? He would be at the side of the football pitch in a suit with a plaster cast on crutches, and then he was trying to direct the game with his crutches. And for some reason, that annoyed me more than him trying to get Matt Bound and Andy Crosby to play kind of flowing passing game out of defence. And I don't know why that really really sticks with me. I mean, not his. His 20.7 win percentage probably ought to annoy me more, but it doesn't.
Well, I was glad that he had that percentage, because he got sacked quicker.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, it was a terrible, terrible period, doesn't it?
Mm. But, you know, at the same time, it shows that football's moved on, because there's absolutely no way he would get a manager position now.
But same era. I really like phases of any football club's history that has retrospective chin-stroking articles in The Guardian and other broadsheet newspapers. The Ramon Diaz era was fantastic. And, you know, for all of the things that Feroz Kassam has done to our football club on a negative front, the fact that he brought Ramon Diaz and his entourage to us is something I will forever be thankful for, because it was wonderful.
That was brilliant.
Was that am I right in saying that was the one that started off where nobody was sure who was going to be manager, and it was before the internet, and the Oxford Mail had got a tip off and they published a headline on the back page of the Oxford Mail was, "It's Chris Turner." And then it wasn't Chris Turner. It was Ramon Diaz, this international footballer.
Well, I think Chris Turner had been seen in the South Stand Upper, because we'd played a midweek game just before it was announced. So I remember somebody describing Ramon Diaz's preferred players as nippy little shits.
I didn't realise that that's my favourite type of player.
But that presumably why he kept picking Emiliano Diaz as well, because I can't think of any other reason why he would have kept picking him.
He wasn't in the country very often because he had lots of visa problems. There was a guy called Horacio...
Yes, Rodriguez.
Rodriguez, yeah, that's right. So he was the head coach, and he was effectively the man on the touchline. I don't remember that, to be honest. My mind is plays tricks on me, and that Diaz was at the touchline. But he didn't go to away games, Diaz. Just couldn't be asked.
I do remember that, because I was reading some old programmes the other day, and I opened it up, and it was from the dugout, Horacio Rodriguez. Who the hell is this?
But it was
no memory of him whatsoever. But so it was this I sort of looked into it a little bit.
It was this just gigantic entourage, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that was kind of, and you know, all of these kind of international players like Matteo Corbo and Juan Pablo Rapponi and all of their like their flamboyant foreign ways that are introducing to us a whole different world of football. And it was just, it was so wonderful and exciting. And what makes it even better is the way it all massively unfolded.
Yeah.
Like in such unbelievably oxygenated fashion.
Yeah.
So what am I right in saying that effectively Kassam started getting a bit twitchy because they started kind of sniffing around because it looked like actually what they were really interested in was taking over the football club. And Firas Kassam was like, well, hang on a minute, this wasn't what I signed up for. So he kind of ushered them out. And then after they left, he then banned them from the stadium.
Yeah.
So then they bought tickets and came into the Oxford Mail Stand.
No. Well, they didn't get in. No, so the last game of the season, we were playing Chester. And yeah, they got basically barred from coming in. Obviously, because the stadium's so open, the fans could actually see them walking around trying to find their way in, including, as you say, buying tickets. And they were blocked at every given, you know, every opportunity. So there's this massive entourage walking around the Kassam Stadium, trying to storm the stadium. With Oxford fans, we were losing, and Oxford fans kind of going, singing, you know, let them in, let them in. It was like a siege mentality. It was incredible. Firas Kassam loading up his trebuchet and firing out, burning oil.
But Scott, you mentioned this previously, this weird week where Darren Patson was made manager.
It was 3 games in 8 days, which also concluded with a storming, which was against Bristol Rovers, a midweek game? And fans stormed the our stand upper or the executive boxes below.
It was up in. So I followed them. You were leaving. I followed them and then I got scared. Like, I'm done now. I'm not going any further. Yeah, so they went up to the executive boxes. They went through the quadrangle and up. But when they got that far, I was like, oh, I'm going to go.
Because what else?
I don't fancy this now.
What do you actually do at that point?
that was probably the point I was getting to. Was like,
were they demanding the reinstatement of Brian Talbot?
Was that before or after Talbot, though?
Well, it was after Talbot, and it must have been literally days before they announced Jim Smith and Mary taking over.
Mm. That's right. March 2006, so the week between Talbot and the return of Jim Smith.
So I always look back at Brian Talbot and I appreciate there were other circumstances afoot at the football club at this time. But I always use him as an example where people say, we really need somebody with experience of getting a football team out of this division.
Mm.
I always point to Brian Talbot because his appointment was really well heralded by supporters, saying because he got Rushden and Diamonds promoted. And it's like, this guy's going to do a fantastic job for Oxford. He knows how to get a team out of this division. They introduced him on a pitch, didn't he? And they gave him a microphone and he gave us a little bit of a speech before he started. And the only thing I remember from his little intro speech was he's going to improve communication with the fans.
Wow. I mean, as a man who's ahead of his time.
Well, yeah, quite.
Did he promise to tweet at least once?
And then he went, oh, you can't see me, strong arm.
No, but he had been set some sort of smart targets, but they were decidedly underwhelming. They were things like third round of the FA Cup, the playoffs, and the regional semi-finals of the auto windscreen or whatever it was at the time. And that was the ambition that he had been set for that season.
And he didn't achieve.
He didn't achieve any of them. No.
The only thing I really remember about Talbot's time in charge was Rushden Diamonds away when he played up front. He played Yemi and Neville Roach, who I think were both about 5'2", and Rushden had these big bruising defenders.
Did we play it long to them? But yeah, I mean, he if the buck stops with the manager, he ultimately set us on a course of getting relegated from the Football League. Yeah, it's not a great legacy for Oxford United. But of course, the man who did get us relegated from the Football League was Jim Smith,
our best manager apparently.
Well, I was kind of
not in my experience.
Well, I was thinking, yeah, us oldies need to wax lyrical about about Jim Smith. But you talked about what would have happened if Appleton hadn't gone to Leicester. So, what would have happened if Jim Smith hadn't left at the end of that promotion season and gone to QPR pretty much for the rest of that.
Yeah, it's difficult to say, isn't it? And then what would his legacy have been The truth is that our first season in the top flight was saved by John Aldridge. Our defence, even though it was Shotton and Briggs and Langan and really fabled players, we were defensively very poor. And Jim Smith was never a defensively minded manager. So whether he would have actually had the wherewithal or desire to be a sort of smarter, to upgrade the defence, I don't know if he would have done. I don't know if he would have done more than Maurice Evans. What would have made the difference is if we'd actually, same old problem, but moved from the Manor, because that was still the big blockage, was that because Maxwell couldn't get planning permission for a new stadium. There's lots of what ifs, but had we moved stadiums, kept Jim Smith, and there hadn't been a European ban, I reckon we could be a reasonably established Premier League club by now. We had an opportunity to move into that sort of space, but we just burnt our matches before the Premier League came along.
And with only a couple of exceptions, most of the teams that were around when the Premier League started stuck around. That was your gateway, because when you were there, when the money suddenly started unfolding, if you were there to take that check, then you stood a better chance.
I think for some people, Jim Smith's reputation was tainted somewhat by us getting relegated to the Conference, but for those of us of a certain age,
I don't know that it was. I mean, I like to joke about it that he was the man who relegated us out of the league, but I, you know, of course, everybody. I mean, they, you know, the young kids in the East Stand, they still sing songs about him. Yeah. Everybody knows. There's pictures of him in the stadium. I don't think it's tainted at all. And I don't think anybody really blames him for that, even though we were 7 points clear when he took over. And Pato was going to bring in Jim Magill and Steve Clark. But, you know, it's
not. I agree with all that. I do wonder, had we been relegated to the Conference without what Jim Smith had delivered previously, whether we would have sustained any kind of hope of returning. Had we not gone through that period and we'd ended up in the Conference, if you look at other teams like Torquay, Rochdale, small teams that hit a bad patch and went down and then kept going, we could easily have been in that situation. And I think Jim Smith and the fans that he generated during his time helped us get through that period. I mean, obviously, Chris Wilder played a big role in terms of delivering the team, but just in terms of delivering any degree of hope, Jim Smith's legacy kind of shined through that.
But I remember when they took over, I was a van driver at the time, and I remember I was in Abingdon, and I'd got the Oxford Mail, and I put it in the front of a van, and I was driving around, and like two separate occasions in the middle of Abingdon, people saw it and like waved and were like sticking their thumbs up at me and like cheering and stuff like that, because there was so much excitement for everything that Jim Smith did for us in the 80s, and that puts him right at the top of our kind of statistically our best managers for people that managed a good number of games. But he also generated this completely unquantifiable sense of kind of excitement and joy when he came back in. Now, it didn't work out in the long run with him as manager, but all of that aside, that gave us confidence to tackle the Conference issue. And once we kind of got over ourselves a little bit and got used to the fact that just being a big fish wasn't big enough, as a group of supporters, I think we really kind of made it happen. And I just genuinely don't think that would have been possible without Jim.
I think you're absolutely right.
I just, whilst we're talking about him, I want to just kind of put in a tiny little personal story as well, because I was doing the radio at this point, and I had subsequent managers who were very, very unpleasant to people off air when you're interviewing them, and sometimes on air when you're interviewing. Jim Smith was the nicest guy. He was just so enthusiastic. He was loving his time there, and he was interested. And I this is something I talk about Mickey Lewis as well. He was interested in you as a person, so he'd ask you questions and say, "Did you enjoy the game? What did you think about that?" So he would ask you off air. He would ask you questions, and he was really kind of all of the positive, wonderful, amazing things that he did as a really, really good football manager. He was also an absolutely brilliant bloke. Mm. And I feel incredibly privileged to have met in a tiny, tiny small part that I did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for me, for that reason, Jim Smith is one of my two favourite Oxford managers. I think he's brilliant. And I absolutely fucking love that we have a song about him still.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I do.
Should we do a quiz?
Quiz time. This one is called Going for Oldfield.
It's catchy.
Yeah, by sheer coincidence, this quiz is going to be based on a game that we've been speaking about, the one where Ramon Diaz and his cohort were trying to get into the ground. They left with one game to play at the end of the 2004-2005 season. David Oldfield stepped in as caretaker for that one game. I hadn't realised that he was actually appointed caretaker manager when Atkins was sacked, but the next match was postponed, and in the meantime, Ricks came in. So he was the caretaker manager who never managed an actual match.
Well, it's not true. It was the Mansfield match that was called off at half time. So he was manager for 45 minutes.
You're still really annoyed by that, about that match, aren't you?
Yeah, because they wouldn't give us a refund. We'd watched 45 minutes of football. They wouldn't refund the tickets or let you use them again. Shitbags.
Well, sorry, I'm really sorry to have hit a nerve.
I mean, at some point you're going to hit a nerve, probably. I've got a lot of nerve to hit about.
So, as Scott mentioned, we were playing Chester City, yeah, and we lost. So if you let me know what you think the attendance was, then that will determine who gets first go at naming a member of the starting 11 and or a playing substitute.
I know I was at the game, so I've increased the number by one.
Okay. Well, more for you, because I was as well. You didn't put me on there.
3,972.
Yeah, I've gone 5,368.
I've done Scott. Gone 5,163, because I was also there.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Scott is the closest. It was 5,055. So, Scott, you're only just about 100 out. So, Scott, do you want to name a player from that?
Tommy Mooney.
Tommy Mooney is correct. It's your go again.
Matteo Corbo
is correct.
Matt Robinson.
Matt Robinson, that's correct. Ooh, as well.
Flipping heck. Okay, Scott McNiven then.
No, Scott McNiven is not here. So the next closest was Rosie. So do you want to have a go?
Okay. So I'm going to say Dave Mackay.
Correct.
In goal, I reckon Chris Tardiff.
Yeah, Tardiff, that's right.
I think I've used all my energy on remembering Dave Mackay. Cominelli?
No.
And you said you were there.
I was really, really, really pleased with myself for thinking of Chris Tardiff. And now I'm in a huge, huge muddle. okay. This might not be the right era. Dave Waterman.
No, afraid not.
Lee Bradbury.
That is correct.
Ooh. Dave Woosley.
No, he didn't play that match. Back to Rosie.
This is really, really hard. How is Dave Mackay the only one I can fucking remember?
Well, he was one of the players substituted off.
Okay.
The player replacing him, I can't recall at all.
Oh, I like those ones. Carl Pettifer.
No. Sorry.
Steve Basham.
Steve Basham is correct.
Oh, we played with Basham, Bradbury and Mooney.
This is insane.
I still didn't score.
Go on again.
Okay. Andy.
So we must have been playing 4-3-3.
Or 5-2-1-3.
Don't be ridiculous.
okay, sorry. I've got to come up with another player, haven't I?
I was just stalling for you.
Thanks, I really appreciated that. Matt Day.
No, sorry.
Rob Folland.
No.
Chris Wilmot.
No.
John Ashton.
No.
<Jesus. laughs> It's like one of those penalty shootouts where they're all blazed over the bar. I'm going to have to pass.
Billy Beeches.
Correct. Yeah, well in there.
Tommy Mooney.
He came on a sub. Amazing.
He came on a sub, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You love Billy Beeches.
Yeah. That's absolutely legendary football name, Billy Beeches, isn't it?
It's you again, where's you?
Terry Parker.
No.
In prison by then.
It's really funny because people listening to this probably screaming names out all over the place.
They're probably turned off by now.
Terry Parker was in prison, yeah, later that summer. It's 18 months. He got involved in a violent pub brawl. Yeah. Punched one man in the face, hit him over the back with a chair, then chased others into a raised area in the pub where he held another chair at them.
Or was he just like reenacting a Western?
The piano player stopped.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Is it me?
Yeah.
It is.
I was going to say somebody, but I think he was a striker. So, I mean, we can't possibly have had five strikers during that
game.
Might
have been a sub, though.
Craig Davis.
Good hit. Craig Davis is correct, yeah. Came on for Corbo, apparently.
Of course he did.
I think this might be too early for him, but Barry Quinn?
Barry Quinn's correct. Oh. That's what Rosie was going to get, you see.
Yeah, I would have said that was too early, but yeah, of course.
I could start giving some clues.
I'm not ready for clues yet. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Oh, God. Yeah, Andy doesn't like clues.
Shush.
Never say, guess who I saw today? Because that's a long conversation.
Again, I think this might be too early for him, but Chris Zabrowski?
That's not right.
He's conference, isn't he?
Yeah. Chris Hackett.
Chris Hackett, oh, yeah. Correct.
I nearly said it.
Lee Mansell. Oh, sorry, it's not my go, is it?
Do I take it, though? Sorry. Because that's a good one.
Bollocks.
Lee Mansell.
Incorrect.
I can't believe you fell for my trap. Well, so, Lee Molyneux.
Correct.
Oh.
That is impressive.
Exactly. Mark Ibea.
No, sorry.
I'm really starting to struggle to think of any footballers anymore. So I think this is wildly wrong, but I'm going to say it anyway. Paul Wanless.
Paul Wanless. Oh,
yes!
I'm just not sure anyone's going to get this final player. Paul, I'm
we've never
but
heard
you know
of.
His first name.
Paul. Are we nearly right?
Yeah, like the Mansfield game, it's 50%.
Too soon, Rich. Too soon.
Paul McLaren. No, he played more than two games anyway, what we're talking about. He played loads.
It's going to be a youngster, isn't it?
See, I'm Googling him and I can't even find anything on him.
We're going to be...
Yeah, I think we're beaten.
Yeah, we're going to have to give Andy the point.
Okay, so no one hits home and hits the jackpot. It's Paul Burton.
No.
So at the end of that round, Scott's on five, Rosie on four, Andy on four.
Well but done. Andy gets the points for the last player, doesn't he?
No, no one got the last player. But the real winner is Paul Burton.
There's a slight aside, I've just been slightly distracted because the account called Daily Oxford United Content on Twitter, the Oxblogger franchise, has been entered into the Ultimate Oxford United Fan World Cup.
We're currently
pissing all over Jake. I don't know who he is.
There's a lot of people voting on this.
Yeah, yeah.
157 votes.
Wow.
Yeah.
You are streaming ahead, Scott. 82.6%.
If we can't beat that little pipsqueak, then that's the point.
Take that, Jake, you little...